From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where each week we deal with a variety of mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means body, mind, and spirit. And the importance in my own private practice and my own life is finding and helping to create and taking responsibility for the balance in terms of what's going on in your mind psychologically and emotionally, your body in terms of health and well-being, and spirit in terms of an open heart, a peaceful heart, and a space of balance and love and connectedness. And that's really what this show's been about for the last, I've been on the air on this station and another station for the last 4 years. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we've always asked on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Now, before I go any further into today's show, first of all, I want to acknowledge my niece's birthday this week, Sarah Grisham. I also really want to let you know that today's show is dedicated to the memory of Betty Brazon, who died last week at age 78. She was an incredible psychotherapist in Los Angeles, an amazing writer, an activist, and in many issues, from women's rights to gay and lesbian rights. She helped founded the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Community Service Center in 1971, which took a lot of courage for the people who got that started back then. And I really want to acknowledge her and her partner, Terry, for all that they've done. And finally, I know that 20 years ago today was the day of the Challenger astronauts explosion and their death, and I really want to acknowledge that and acknowledge all the people that have taken those kind of risks to move us further in our history, in our lives, and in research. So I also have one announcement I'd like to make. A friend of mine named Jim Walton has produced a series of CDs. He's a psychotherapist and a hypnotherapist. And he has a website called hypnocd.com. That's hypnocd.com. And from hypnocd.com, you'll find the fastest way to stop smoking naturally and drug-free through an effective hypnosis treatment program that can free you from smoking forever in just minutes. You want freedom from cigarettes? Now you can have it. Log on to hypnocd.com. And for the fastest way to fall asleep, which I've actually used his CD for this, so I've never been a smoker, but I've used it for this, fall asleep naturally and easily and drug-free. Experience total relaxation through an exclusive hypnosis process that goes deep into the unconscious to carry you into the deepest, most peaceful sleep you have ever experienced. So I really support these. I've used one of them. I actually had a client use the Stop Smoking one, and it was very successful. So log on to hypnocd.com. That's hypnocd.com. And I want to thank Jim for all his support in my practice and on my show over the years. Now, with all that being said, today's show is titled Healing the Wounded Spirit. It's actually about healing from abuse. Now, we've done shows before on abuse, child abuse, spousal abuse, elder abuse. Abuse is abuse, and it tends to have a similar pattern in each. It tends to be generational, which means the abused usually goes on to be an abuser if they're not treated properly and their consciousness raised and behaviors changed and the inner pains healed. And that's really what today's show is going to be about. It's about the healing process, the journey that all of us take, no matter what our issues, whether we've been abused or not, that takes courage and takes a willingness and takes a lot of support in terms of stopping the cycle, whatever it's been in your life, whether it's just low self-esteem, whether it's hiding from who you are in the world, whether it's holding yourself back from your own greatness. But today we're going to be talking about the cycle of abuse, how to stop it, and somebody's own journey in this issue. And she is the author of a book called Slow Hope. Her name is Anita Swanson. And I actually read this book twice, because a few months ago I was supposed to have her on as a guest, and I always read as much of the books of my guests as possible. But this is a really good read. I read it all through once, and just it didn't take long. It's a great book. And because she wasn't on then but is on this week, I reread it this week and got even more out of it. So I want to welcome Anita Swanson to the show today. Anita, are you there?
I am here.
Well, welcome, and I'm actually glad you weren't on earlier because it gave me a chance to get another read of Slow Hope.
I'm flattered. I'm really flattered. Thank you so much. You
sound... It was really a really good read, and one of the things... With me, with ADD, I talk about this on the air all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to absorb things sometimes in technical books,
mm-hmm.
and I lose my ability to stay focused. What I really love are books that do its instructing and teaching mm-hmm. in the concept of storytelling, much like Native Americans have always done and most cultures have always had.
Mm-hmm.
They make their points and they use metaphors and they tell their stories to teach people through storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I loved about this book. In spite of the topic, it was a fun read,
mm-hmm.
it was a profound read, and I know that it wasn't just you creating a story. I know in your materials here, it was
mm-hmm.
really... very autobiographical, if I understand it correct.
That's correct. Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about who you are. I know that you're a writer, and I know that you were a nurse,
mm-hmm.
and that you live in Northern California. And tell us a little bit about your story and how you came to write this book, if you would.
Oh, I'd be happy to. I retired after 31 years of nursing. I dealt mostly in clinical areas that were acute, so I always did ICUs, and I ran an emergency room on nights for 9 years, and I did recovery rooms and those kinds of intense settings. And I retired from nursing after 31 years and then went to the UCLA Writers Program and enrolled in that program and began writing essays. After raising two daughters by myself and going through a rather stormy divorce, I had remarried at that point and had the flexibility and the time to pursue the writing. So I did that and began writing essays, and the essays I thought were just standalone essays, and began to read them at different writers' conferences and workshops across the United States, and then started to get a lot of reinforcement and started resonating with the women and the men in the conferences, and had a great deal of encouragement to go to Iowa, the University of Iowa, and pursue the writing there, and was very glad that I did, and began to get the idea that this could be a book, that the book might have a broader message than just surviving child abuse, but that you could actually practice courage, because I'm a strong believer in courage in little doses will get you where you need to go.
I agree. Start with the small steps, and it'll build you to the next one.
Right, because if I had realized, you mentioned in your opening remarks about courage, and if I had thought that I was going to have enough courage to do the journey in the beginning of how much courage it was going to take, I would have said, no, I can't do this. But if you do little steps of courage and practice courage, then the universal message, I think, comes out in that if you persist, then your courage will grow. And then if you can face your past, you can heal your past. And so the message became a universal message, and then eventually I put all the essays together and it became a book.
Uh-huh. So you said something I think is very important, which to me is one of the cornerstones of what therapy is about, which is if you can face your past, you can heal your past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very well put, because those people that are in denial or avoiding, who think, I can do this on my own,
mm-hmm.
Usually have a much rougher road if they're able to achieve the healing at all.
Mm-hmm.
That none of us are alone in any of what we're going through, even when we feel that somewhere, somehow, and you use the character in the book, which I'm assuming was you too, finding Margaret, I think her name was,
mm-hmm.
at the Bible study group, which
mm-hmm.
helped you open some doors and some windows and help you feel less alone.
Mm-hmm. I think that support is critical. It's difficult, I think. I don't think I'm alone in this, but it's difficult for people who have come through some traumatic events in their life, whether they're abused or they've been in a crisis, to sometimes reach out. The event is too shaming, or it's produced a feeling in you that you just don't want to talk about it. But for me, it was building up of events that finally said, well, I know that you think you can cope, Anita, but this is too much for you. So when I found Margaret, I found an ally in spirit who really was also interested in mental and emotional health. But it takes willingness to accept the help,
mm-hmm.
and that's a tough one sometimes.
Right. Sometimes it's willingness mixed with enough desperation. You know,
yeah, that's great.
You know,
that's
what
Culpepper's
call hitting bottom, where you know that either you're going to die or you have no other chance than to reach out, no other option but to reach out and start help getting some help and pulling yourself up.
Right. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah,
excellent.
So, again, mm-hmm. this story was your story,
mm-hmm.
From what I understand, in terms of you growing up in a house where there was abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many issues on so many levels in this book. And like I said, this is what I love about a book that unfolds in the form of a story.
Mm-hmm.
You have the issue of abuse, repressed memories of childhood abuse. You
right.
have the issue of, and I want to talk about this, because the first marriage was looking for the knight in shining armor to come and rescue you and be your savior and
mm-hmm.
take you out of this and have all the answers for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so many of us look for that in the form of another human being and in the relationship that we're seeking,
mm-hmm.
And not take personal responsibility for doing the work on their own. I'd like to actually start by asking you that question in terms of the character Anne and in terms of you, Anita.
Mm-hmm.
So many people do this, you know, false hope that somebody's going to rescue them from their pain and suffering and make life wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that for a minute in terms of the character as well as you, in terms of the first marriage in the story.
Well, I can only give you my perspective, but what I believe is that when you come out of a childhood that is severely I don't want to say deprived physically, but in the sense that it's emotionally very, you're starving, you tend to fantasize. And you tend to fantasize then in this kind of Cinderella world that someone, surely someone is going to love you and surely someone is going to save you, and you put those two together. And fantasy is fed by the media. Fantasy is fed by your friends getting married. Fantasy is fed by any number of things that say, if only I had someone who understood me, if only I had someone who loved me. And at that point in my life, I was pretty much in denial about the existence that I had come out of, and I was living in a time when adult children of alcoholics received very little attention, because at the time that I was growing up, it was the child who was the problem. If there was something wrong in the family, it was because the child had gone bad.
Right.
Rather than the parents, what kind of parenting had they done? So it took several years for that kind of psychotherapy and forward thinking to really birth itself in America, so that I became then the recipient of that kind of groundbreaking work. And by that time, the marriage was floundering badly, and my knight in shining armor had become quite severely tarnished and had also started replicating, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, I was going to go there. Go ahead.
Huh?
I was going to go there. You're already making a point I was going to make, but finish your thought.
Replicating the behaviors that I had grown up with, and I was going, well, now this is beginning to feel all too familiar. And you had mentioned earlier in your opening remarks about freedom, and freedom became an obsession with me toward the end of my first marriage. I had a cumulative effect of, you know, my family and then my first marriage, and beginning to recognize that freedom was going to cost me dearly, but it was what I wanted and I was willing to develop within myself to say, freedom is what I want. Freedom is something I can have if I'm willing to do the work on myself rather than depend on somebody else to make me free.
Mm-hmm. Now, this all took place at a time in society where, number one, therapy wasn't necessarily something that people were proud of going into. It's usually a stigma to say, I'm seeing a psychologist. And divorce was not necessarily something that came easily, especially, and we haven't even gotten into the fact that I won't even call it a subtext, because I really think it was a very important aspect of what this book is about, was Christians don't get divorced. And not being a Christian myself, it was beautifully written and very instructionally written, and it was a lot of insights I already had, because I deal with a lot of different spiritual belief systems and denominations and things like that. So it's a very important aspect to talk about in terms of, number one, the husband turning into the abusive parent that we very rarely are conscious of when we're going into that first relationship, and sometimes the second or third and the fourth, where if we don't get the work done, we keep marrying or partnering with the same person over and over again. So, but you had, number one, the fundamental Christian issues that you were dealing with. Number two, being in therapy, which in some ways is contradictory for getting the help. You should have gone to a minister instead of a therapist, and divorce. So you had like three things going on, and I realize I'm talking about you and the character Anne at the same time. How did all of that play out for you, and how did you help Anne experience that triple struggle?
With great difficulty. I think, honestly, I think if you're a Christian in that environment and you start talking divorce, you start talking about walking through a minefield. And if you're married to, at that time, a high-profile Baptist minister of music, and they function oftentimes as in the pulpit. If the minister's away, oftentimes the minister of music, who is directing four or five choirs, will step over and function in the pulpit as well, or they'll conduct community hymn sings, or they will do any kinds of functions that an ordained minister can do, because oftentimes their roles are like cross-training. So my situation, and it was a huge church, was extremely dangerous for me in the sense that there was considerable pressure for me to not even say the word divorce, not even consider the word divorce, and that the public at large supported my husband at that time because he had such a great public image. And I think that any person in the church, as a Christian, will struggle with that more than someone who is not in an organized religion. But having said all of that, George Barna, who is sort of the guru of Christian statistics, has said that, you know, the Christians have a higher divorce rate, and in particular in the Bible Belt. They're higher than non-organized religions. And so something is failing within the church itself. But at the
How would you explain that? There must be some theories about it.
Well, just the articles that I've read, they have done a lot of work in terms of, particularly in Oklahoma, have taken their statistics quite seriously, and they're doing a lot of premarital counseling. A lot of it comes from they're encouraging them no premarital sex and kids running off to get married so they can be, you know, sexually active. Then the lack of maturity and the people that want to have the fairy tale wedding but really don't want to have the marriage, and you know, all of these things tie in. And so they started having intensive marriage preparation courses in some of these churches now where they never had them before, which is great. But, I mean, it was – this is all within the last 5 years,
mm-hmm.
all these statistics and all these, these advents of new programs. But truthfully, when I started therapy, the church had told me that I was – Not that I was satanic, but the therapist was probably satanic.
Mm-hmm.
And the fundamental church at that time was quite vocal about it. They weren't the only ones, but they were quite vocal about, if you see a therapist, you're going to pave your way to hell. And I understood this only because I had been indoctrinated in this religion to understand that they really believed in prayer and let anybody else in, and you start opening your mind to possibly ways that the devil can get at you,
yeah.
and this kind of thing. So
let me interrupt you for 1 minute, because
sure.
there's a paragraph here I really want to read. It's on page
sure.
151 that really makes this statement. And in the book, Anne is talking to her therapist about what her husband Bob's beliefs are.
Yeah, I know.
And she says, if you have a concern or – this is what Bob says to her that she's
right.
relating to the therapist. If you have a concern or need, you pray about it, and
mm-hmm.
God will answer your prayers. If you go to someone else to help you, you're not trusting God's spirit to help you.
Mm-hmm.
You're trusting in an earthly person, someone with skin on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, once you've done that, you've opened the door for Satan to influence you through the teachings of other people.
Correct. That's absolutely
It was beautifully put. I underlined it even when I read it.
Oh. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So when I went into therapy at that time, I got a lot of helpful prayer.
Mm-hmm.
From people who wanted, were concerned,
mm-hmm.
and to change my way of thinking. But they really supported. Finally, they said I could go if it was a Christian counselor, and if I was one step away from being committed to a psych hospital.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, okay, I feel good. I can fulfill those requirements pretty easily, and that's when I found my therapist. And I stuck to it in spite of. I mean, I really stuck to it. I was committed to getting healthy. And finding my own way of thinking and finding my own way of understanding God as told to me by God as opposed to being told to me by the Baptist Church or mm-hmm. my husband at that time.
Right. Which basically, again, you know, I keep relating this back to therapy from a holistic perspective, which to me, another cornerstone of what therapy is about, is helping a client reconnect with their own inner voice. And to me,
mm-hmm.
that inner voice is a spirit. And
mm-hmm.
to learn to differentiate between when it's truly that inner voice and when it is your ego really trying to destroy you.
I hear
that's what you're saying in religious or spiritual terms. It's really learning to listen to the voice of God, however you want to call it.
Correct.
And know that the support is there and that it need not come through a minister or anyone else. You know, if you believe in spirit and God guiding us, then it stands to reason that spirit or God led you to that therapist.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Absolutely
mm-hmm.
correct. And I have had Christians and non-Christian therapists. I've been, someone said, my goodness, but you're a well-therapized individual. And I owe my life to them. I literally owe my life. And my children owe their life to them. You know, it's been a fabulous gift to me.
Great. As a therapist, when I was reading the book, I couldn't help but start getting some gut feelings about Bob's diagnosis of narcissism and manic depression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just needed to put that out because I may not have another chance to ask you, is that something that is that you sensed was going on with him or can look back on it and see it now, or is it just something that I just am creating here?
No, I think that's an accurate understanding. I don't think that I think the narcissism is pretty clear.
Yes.
The manic depression, it was like only in retrospect and looking back can I see that. And later on in his life and just prior the last few years, it was more like a depressed state than anything. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I can totally see that completely now.
Uh-huh. The other thing, I'll tell you, there was only one thing in the entire book that didn't ring true for me.
Okay.
In terms of my reaction, and I'm really glad to get that, because I felt the same way the first time as well as the last time.
Okay.
And without giving too much away for the people reading it, it was the very last scene you had with the therapist where you said that you were going to stop coming for a while.
Right.
And the way you depicted him throughout the book was really the kind of therapist that I really value and like to see myself as.
Right.
And the way he reacted to you stopping,
right,
which was very egocentric and accusative,
right,
doesn't seem like the way he would have reacted at the time. Was that a reality in terms of your interaction with him? Or?
Yeah, it was pretty. The only thing I did was sort of time collapse it. It took a few more months than that, but he actually had sort of like a, I don't know what you could call it. He had sort of like a break or something because he left his wife and married a patient.
Oh, okay.
Right after that. So, that's pretty accurate. But I was the beginning of that cycle in his life,
mm-hmm,
where things sort of came apart for him. And, that's accurate. The only thing that's not accurate is that it took a few more. Instead of weeks, it probably took 2 or 3 months.
So basically what you're talking about is the humanity of a therapist.
Right.
We are humans and we have our own issues going on. And the important thing is that we stay conscious enough not to leak them on the clients that we're working with.
Right, and when I found out, truth be told, when I found out that he was going to go ahead and leave his wife and marry this other patient, I said, well, he, you know, and there was all this aghast and la, la, la. And I was like, you know, he was there when I needed him. And without him, I wouldn't have survived. So, you know, I am indebted to him and still am.
Good. It's great to be able to have that kind of perspective that, you know, there are a lot of people, when somebody does something wrong, they judge them. There's no forgiveness. There's no understanding the context in which it happened. And I really honor you for being able to differentiate between his problems and issues and the gifts he was able to have when you needed them.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm indebted to him and deeply,
mm-hmm,
deeply.
Another issue in the book, again, getting back to God and Christianity, and people in the past that have listened to the show know that while the show is about mental health, this is, you know, spirituality and religion and God is something that I bring into this a lot, so this book is actually very perfect. Is the issue of that people have been asking throughout human history, is why does God allow abuse or suffering?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in this book, clearly, you were going through a lot of abuse and a lot of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a point where you really thought this was something that God gave you, or was God's fault? You know, because the character Bob certainly kept saying that in the book.
Mm-hmm. In the sense that I understand that God allows suffering, he allowed it. In the sense that he caused it, I don't go that far. I know that there are people that do. Mm-hmm. I know that people say, well, God causes everything, period. And I think that God, in my lifetime, has been there for me, even in the worst of times. But when I speak to groups, I say to them that, you know, sometimes you think that God has given everyone his forwarding address, but he didn't give it to you.
Yeah.
And there's this sense of, wait a minute, everybody seems to be connected to him, but not me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to come through that without having some really horrific questioning days. And I think that my help then came from hanging on and knowing that God had a purpose for my life, even if it wasn't clear to me then. But that came pretty close to being ended. I mean, it was pretty horrific in a couple of places. And so at that point in time, I think that you just have to understand that your support group is going to get you through when you can't get yourself through.
Mm-hmm. And the issue there also is a bigger one, and I had that reaction, and my heart really goes out to those coal miners and their families in West Virginia that got stuck in the mine, and all but one of them died. It was the night that it was announced that they found them and that they all survived, and all the interviews of all the people who were waiting, their relatives, said, God answered our prayers, they're alive because of our prayers, and you know, this is God's will type of thing. And then a few hours later, it was determined that almost all of them had died. Mm-hmm. And it to me, it kind of brought home that point of putting too much credit into what God does and doesn't do in the context of the world. Mm-hmm. And if you're giving him all this credit, does that mean you give him the blame too?
Right, right. You know? I think that's something. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No.
I just think that's something that you need to assess for your own personal well-being. I tend, you know, I don't always like saying, I mean, I'd rather give God too much credit than too little. But I think he allows suffering, and I think that people can grow through suffering. But I honestly, if there was another way to have learned these lessons, I would have found it. Believe me.
I think most of us say that when we're getting through our
like,
darkest days.
You know,
and to me, it is a point to be able to learn from love instead of learning from pain and suffering.
Right. You know,
that to me is the ultimate goal.
Right.
Be so conscious that when you need a lesson, you get it without having to go through your dark night of the soul again.
I can second that one. Absolutely.
Again, there's so much in this book. And I also want to remind, I know that we have about 20 minutes left, and I forgot to say this at the top of the show. This is a live call-in show today. And if there's any of you out there that want to ask a question or make a comment or share some of your own story, the number in Phoenix is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. And it's the same number if you're listening via the Internet outside the Phoenix area. So, the issue here, another one of the issues that kept coming back is, and I underlined it because Anne in the book says this a number of times, it wasn't supposed to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
And she keeps going, it wasn't supposed to be like this. And she kept, it just kept being this thing that gnawed at her that Bob was supposed to be her savior, that a childhood is supposed to be joyous and fun and innocent. Being a mother is supposed to be joyous and fun and innocent. It wasn't supposed to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a phrase that I think every one of us has said to ourselves at one point or another.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that for a minute in terms of how invasive that thought was to you through most of your life and how you got past it.
Yeah, I think that we all come... I think it's sort of a universal feeling to understand that we have expectations. And I think that most of us think on a positive level in terms of we expect that it's going to be good, or we expect that it's going to be that people are going to be kind. And when that is destroyed at a very early age, as it was in my case, there was this tremendous, tremendous awakening in me when I was 5 and 6 years old, that things were askew, and this was my first introduction into looking around at other children and looking around at other families and then looking at mine and going, wait a minute, you know, looking at my family and saying, this is not right, this isn't supposed to be like this, and that became a mantra that I wasn't able to fix until I got into therapy, because from that point on, from the time that I was in kindergarten on, what it wasn't supposed to be like this was an outgrowth of almost every situation I found myself in. I would recreate these situations in which I was accident prone, and the new bike that I got was totally destroyed because I, you know, ran it down a hill and did this and that and ended up in the hospital, and the sled that I got all busted up. I mean, I was everything from my childhood on then became almost the opposite of what it should have been. even though in my mind I still had this fantasy. So as an adult, until I started looking back and going, wait a minute, things were wrong in my childhood. There were definitely things that I needed to look at. But in order to fix that, I had to face that. And that's what was so, A, painful, B, humiliating, and three, shame-filled. And if you can deal with those horrific emotions a little at a time, then the "it wasn't supposed to be like this" can be changed to, well, now this is how it's supposed to be, after you've done the work.
Mm-hmm. And you get me to my next point, actually, and another thing I underlined in your book. When you start therapy, and I hear this from clients all the time after the first session or month of sessions, Anne says in the book, rather than making my life better as I had hoped, therapy began making things worse. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that my sessions didn't go well. They went very well.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's a sign that the therapy is working when it's getting you past the defenses and getting you past the denial and actually getting you more in touch with the things that are painful. And very often, when you start therapy, things sometimes do get more painful and more chaotic in your life as you're finally beginning to go into those dark places. And a lot of people will run from therapy at that point and build the walls up again. What do you say to those people?
Hang on. Hang on, because, and tell the therapist. If you tell the therapist, that was my big mistake. Is I didn't tell anybody. I just kept disintegrating, and then migraine headaches kept getting worse, and I was, you know, I switched from, at one point I say in the book that I, you know, I looked around the house and sort of wondered how it got so dirty and that I was going to have to switch from dishes to paper plates to make things easier and this kind of thing. So, but I kept that from the therapist because I thought that in my lifetime that I was supposed to take care of people and people were supposed to think that I was doing well. It had to get to the point of really severe disintegration before I was like, no, I need to tell somebody that I'm doing really badly. And then if you tell somebody, then they can come alongside you and say, no, sometimes things like that happen. It's like in a medical sense, if you are healing a wound, sometimes the wound looks angry and red when the doctor will come along and say, that looks great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did a great job of suturing
uh-huh.
you up. And it's the same thing emotionally. Sometimes the wound is going to look really angry, and yet that's a great place to start, you know, to continue the healing. But you don't know that until, I mean, a lot of times I've had patients come in the emergency room for rechecks or something, and they'll go, this is totally infected. I know. And I say, no, it looks great. What are you talking about? It looks great.
Uh-huh.
And I say, well, it's healing, you know. And so the same is true emotionally. But you need to tell somebody. You need to tell somebody who knows what they're looking at.
Right. That's the key there because, you know, you told or Anne told Bob, her first husband in the book, and, of course, Bob wasn't willing to hear it and didn't want to take any responsibility and wasn't willing to support Anne in the way she needed. She told her mom and dad, and, of course, that was some of the source of the abuse also.
Mm-hmm.
And mom was so shame-based that she didn't want you to tell anyone else, and she didn't want you to go anywhere with this information because, from what I gathered in the book, she did nothing to stop anything, and she was as frightened of the husband as the kids were and was in a lot of shame of her own and just wanted to pretend like everything was okay.
Right.
So the important thing is who you do pick to open mm-hmm. up to and mm-hmm. to let them know that you need help.
Right. Right. An interesting thing has come out since the book has come out is that the senior ladies will comment to me. By senior, I mean, and more than one. I mean, that's been like the half a dozen, eight ladies will say, if they're in their 80s, they will say things to me like, you know, this happened to me, but we were taught to stay quiet about it and just let bygones be bygones. I mean, they will say, in various ways, they will say that same thing to me over and over again, the senior ladies. The younger women who are anywhere from 25 on up, will say, you know, I loved your book. It should be made into a movie, you know. And the difference in the generation between education of women in determining what is a crime and what isn't a crime has been light years that we've had. It's so fascinating to me because it's just obviously a generation gap
mm-hmm.
between the education of the women.
Right. It's a consciousness, and it's a time in society where these things are talked about now, where in our parents' day it wasn't.
Right.
You know?
Right. And the ladies still are shame-filled. Sweet women, but there's still a lot of shame.
Now, I want to get into another area of abuse, which we've touched on, mm-hmm. which has to do with religion abuse.
Mm.
Because I tell you, as a therapist and as a very holistic therapist, I will ask questions about someone's religion of origin and what the experience was. You know, do they have a spiritual connection, a definition of God in their lives, you know, all that stuff. Because I really do feel it's an important aspect. If you're not dealing with that, you're not dealing with the whole person. And yet I often get people, whether it's people who call themselves recovering Catholics, whether it's the Southern Baptist fundamentalist type of thing that they came out of, the oppressive, you know, what can, and I'm saying that this is sometimes, not everybody experiences their religions like this, but, you know, the Mormon Church, I've worked with a lot of clients that came out of the Mormon Church, the Jewish guilt issue. Mm-hmm. Every religion has has a certain degree of lack of comfort and support for the people in it, and a lot of fear-based, shame-based, and anger in terms of how they define God.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is a result of how men and women have translated it and teach it and live by it.
Mm-hmm.
So that the abuse comes down not just through mom and dad, but also through the religious community.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes with people, it's, I need to break away from it completely, and they reject God, they reject spirit, they certainly reject their religion and family, or they don't know where to go and they just stay in pain. How did you perceive the church and the religion as abusive, or did you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I did. I thought that, I sort of tilt to the left. I mean, I'm sort of off-center in my thinking. And the church likes people who go with the herd mentality and go with the norm. And so somebody who comes along that just sort of rattles their cage, they try to contain that person. But it's also the same whether it's the church or any particular family. I had an interesting, great support person, and he gives me a quote on the back of the book. Reverend Steve Marsh is his name, and his sister, sadly, was murdered by her fundamentalist husband in California, and the church had encouraged her to stay in the marriage and pray about this. And ultimately, he's in prison now, and my friend has adopted the son from that relationship. But he went on television. My friend went on television, and said the church needed to accept, I mean, he's a minister in a church, a big church on the East Coast. And he said the church needed to accept responsibility for what had happened to his sister because of the teachings of the church in that community. And he got hate mail, said that his sister had been martyred for the church. And so he was very, and has been, and still is very supportive of my book to gain new insight in that you can stay in the church, you can be a Christian, you can be different, but you don't have to sacrifice your voice.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to sacrifice saying who you are. And someone asked me, like, how could you still belong to the church after reading the book? And I said, well, I go to a very accepting church of me because I sort of stake my claim that no, I won't join this and no, I won't join that, but, you know, I'm going to be here Sunday mornings, and so I have found my own way to be in the church. But that doesn't mean that it was comfortable. That doesn't mean that I didn't take a lot of criticism, because I did. But I just wasn't going to go away. I just didn't want them to say, "Oh, well, we've disposed of her. She was just a loud noise,
mm-hmm.
and we got her quieted." And then when this happened to Steve and his family and his sister, I was like, no, I have more of a calling than ever to say, no, you can be out there. You can have your voice. And now I have a daughter who is a rock singer at night and has her own rock band and does praise and worship for a big church in Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to just going away, she said, no, I've got rock music and I'm going to do this. And then she got somebody to hire her. And so she found her way that way. So it's easier now than it was, but certainly it's not comfortable. I make people uncomfortable. I know that.
Uh-huh. Because you question.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's kind of like even what the 12-step programs say when they talk about God, they say, as you define him.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what they're saying what you did, which is your religion is still important to you, your church is still important to you, the sense of community is still important to you, the connection is still important to you, but you're not taking everything that's spoon-fed to you for fact, and you're willing to say, I'll take what I need and leave the rest because this works
exactly.
For me, this brings me peace, and this allows me to feel the connection that I didn't have in the past.
That, exactly, and I, you need to know that that makes a lot of people uncomfortable in the church.
I do know that.
Okay.
I mean, and again, I was raised Jewish, and that made people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I see that, like I said, in all my clients where those that question, I mean, even if you look in the world today, I mean, this mm-hmm. is no big news, but how much of the killing that's going on in the world today is in the name of God and in the name of a religion that says mm-hmm. it's supposed to be done?
Right.
And
right.
that's happened throughout history with the Crusades and the Inquisition and so many other things that, you know, this is what God is telling us to do and we have a right to destroy the world because of it.
Mm-hmm. No, I know. Sadly, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it takes more people like you to question. I'm serious. It takes more people like you to question in every religion, whether it's Muslim or Jewish, Buddhist, whatever, to actually stand up and say, you know what, this is destructive, and I don't believe this is really what I believe in a loving God. I don't believe that God wants us to kill in his name or her name.
I'm also getting invitations to speak in churches, which I just finds me stunned. But and I, the most recent one was in Chicago, and I thought, okay, well, there'll be a few people that'll show up. They set up, I think, like 25 chairs, and 140 people came.
Wow. Good for
you.
And
they just kept pouring through the doors, and I was like, where are all these people coming from? I thought everybody had their lives together in this church.
Show me any group of people where everyone has their lives together, and I'll pray there.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. That's great.
Let's see. I had a few other things underlined, too, here. At one point, Anne was, I think this is when they were in Vegas, and she started to see a part of Bob,
right.
which to me was kind of the manic aspect
right.
of him.
Right.
And she said, it bothered me to think that he might be capable of rationalizing his faith to justify his lifestyle, but the
right.
evidence was mounting.
Right.
So many people do that. You
right.
know, even like I just said, people will use their faith to justify killing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or whatever. And so, you know, what do you say to people that have a quote or a way of defending who they are, what they do, or what the group does in the name of God? What do you say to them?
Well, in the case of our pastor of our church, I just say, I'll see you in your office on Monday. And he says something, you know, it's like, and, or he'll, like, look at me, or, like, actually, he's pretty well known, a therapist that's exceedingly well known now. But I mean, when he used to come and speak at our church, he said to me one time, he said, you know, no matter how many people tell me how good I did, when I see you at the end of the line, I go, oh, here comes the truth. And in that sense, I'm pretty challenging. I'm not in your face challenging, but
mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'll just ask them, have you ever thought about, or gee, how does that fit with, or that kind of thing. But I will tell you that if it's an old guard person, and they are many, if they're old guard and they're really like senior in the population, and they've this is the way they've done things, and they justify everything by using the gospel, there's nothing that's going to change them. And so
right.
in my book, they become toxic.
I totally agree with that. And you said something interesting that the minister says, oh boy, here comes the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really what he thinks, that all of a sudden the questions you're going to ask are the questions that he knows he needs to ask himself?
I don't know. I just said, well, I just said, because I challenged him, you know, well, this was great in this one, but this, you know, you need to work on here, because that's, and so I don't know, maybe I consider myself, that's my job.
It is. It's all our jobs, to ask the questions that people are afraid to ask.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this show's about. and the name of it is Tell the Truth Faster. And the whole premise of that is ask the questions that you're afraid to ask. Ask the questions of others that they're afraid to ask. Speak your truth instead of repressing it, because the more you speak your truth, the bigger your life can become.
Yeah, that's true. And I just want to encourage the listeners and myself at the same time that that can only be accomplished by taking those little baby steps of courage. Mm-hmm. When you speak the truth, that people go, and recently someone said, oh, but it upset my whole family when I said X, Y, Z, you know, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I said, well, it sometimes does that.
It usually does that.
You know, I think I've been fortunate enough to speak at the Domestic Violence Center over near Sacramento. And one of the things that they said to me was, when I was talking about the work that has to get done, was I said, the work has to go, it's ongoing work. It's never ending, ongoing. I don't mean like ceaseless work. I'm just talking about new situations are going to present themselves and new things are going to pop up. And life is hard just in general. And if you have this as an issue, then it just becomes you have to go on daily with the work. And they said, I wish you could tell that to the patients. It's work. And the commitment needs to be there, but it isn't always that it has to be 150% commitment. But you have to work at it.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you, because we only have a few minutes left, to final words of wisdom to sum things up, and I think you just did it. but if there's something else left unsaid that you really want to bring home and make sure, first of all, I encourage people to get the book Slow Hope by Anita Swanson, and you could go to her website, which is slowhope.com, and find out where you could get the book and find out more about it and where Anita will be speaking. It's a very simple and really good website. So it's slowhope.com. And so any last words, Anita?
Well, I want to encourage listeners to know that they're going to make wrong decisions. They're going to take the wrong path. They're going to make the wrong choice. And everything is going to seem really dark. I mean, because that's what I did. And I hung on through all of that. And if I can tell them that it's okay, that things just sort of take two steps forward and one step back, and you just keep moving forward that way, and just to hang on when it's the darkest, because the dawn is waiting. It really is.
And the dawn always comes.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
It always comes.
I really want to thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for the book, because I really got a lot out of it both times.
Wow.
And I want to thank you for taking time on the show today. And again, I remind people, if you want to get in touch with Anita, you could do it through slowhope.com or through my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. And this show will be archived on my site within the next week or so. Along with every other show I've done for the last 4 years, are archived there. If there's any topics or anything you need to listen to again, it's right there free of charge on tellthetruthfaster.com. So thank you so much, Anita.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Well, good. So have I, and I hope I know my listeners have too.
Okay.
So to those of you who are out there listening, I just need to let you know that this is probably the last show I'm going to be doing for a little while. I will be back. To tell the truth faster right now, most of it has to do with finances. This show is my passion. This show is my future. The irony of this is just 2 days ago I received from the trademark office the certification that Tell the Truth Faster is now trademarked in my name, and now I'm going to be going off the air for a little while until I can get some steady sponsors, advertisers, people who want to help underwrite this show locally in Phoenix or anywhere in the country. But in the meantime, I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank KXAM and my engineer, Rob, who's been incredible. And I will be back. And if you want to know when, leave your name and email address on tellthetruthfaster.com. And when it starts up again, I will email you along with all the others that get my email. So thank you all for listening. Thank you all for the support for the last 4 years. I will be back, just not next week. And tell the truth faster. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Up high. that I heard of once.